Daoud Ansari, welcome to the show. You're a longtime mutual. We've been kicking around this idea. I've been kicking around the idea of bringing you on the show for a while, and you tagged me in this very interesting post, and this very post about this report that you, I were, I guess, the principal author, right? Principal PI. Were you, is that PI? Is that the term, principal investigator?
We don't use it in academics, but I think people like the term, yeah, essentially.
Yeah, like, I don't even, like, well, as you can tell, my social science power here is very strong. But Doug, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about what you do. And maybe introduce the paper just a tiny bit, and then we'll really get into it.
Absolutely. So thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure. So my name is Daoud Ansari. I'm a I'm an economist by training, although most economists actually do hate me because I do so much uneconomic stuff. So I'm a researcher at the German Institute for Economic Research. And probably most important for this project, I'm the director of the Energy Access and Development Program, which is a small Arab-German NGO. So we're based in Germany, and we mostly work on issues of sustainable development in, I know that's a bad term, but in the Middle East. Let's keep it for a second. So mostly in Yemen, in Jordan, and in Turkey. Yeah, so one of the things that we're doing is we're, again, doing a lot of work on Yemen. So part of the work that we do is literal international development. So doing fundraising for humanitarian projects or building infrastructure. And another thing that we're doing is we're taking over the role of a think tank, and we're looking at many also controversial issues throughout the region, but again, especially in Yemen. And one of these issues is most obviously is the current war. So what we eventually did in our new study is we got a hands on really good data from the Yemen Data Project, which is an independent Yemen NGO. So what they've been doing is they've been recording every single incident of an airstrike on the country throughout the past 6 years. And we got their data. And then we started asking ourselves, okay, it's now 6 years into this horrific war. So what can we learn about the dynamics of the war? And so we started analyzing these dynamics using statistical techniques. And our main result is eventually we found out what, well, people were suspecting all along, that this war is about a lot of things, but at least from what we can see in the dynamics, it's definitely not about saving Yemen or any other weird story that might have been told.
Yeah, I mean, the implications of the war on Yemen and its developments are so huge, and I've had a few episodes on Yemen, and the stuff that I've learned, sort of one of those sort of easy kind of recurring takeaways is that, like, this business of selling it as a civil war is just unfathomably stupid and just obviously just misleading, because it's a very complex to just sort of brush it under the catch-all term civil war. Obfuscates the external factors, massive external factors played by the regional actors and all the sort of global implications. So I, as we were talking just a little bit before, just mentioning the, I was hoping that we can kind of do a more, after getting into the paper and the kind of conclusions of the paper, your methodology, I was thinking we could think in more global terms about the implications of this war, what kind of war this represents, right? Which is, like, you know, combination of like air power, remote air power, right? Like drones and whatever. Although they use their conventional air power.
Exactly, they use both, yeah. But mostly conventional.
Yeah, but also the use of mercenaries and the role the media plays and the role, like, media assets and sort of selling this as just, you know, one of the many civil wars, right? And the fact that this was sold as a civil war for so long, it's kind of like an indictment of, you know, I mean, as if the media needs any more indictments against it, like, whatever. Big news reporting today. The media doesn't do a good job reporting from the region. So breaking, you heard it here, folks. But maybe get into the origins of the paper and tell us, like, a little bit about the conclusions, and then how you sort of actually researched it in terms of, obviously, in the connection with this data that you received. This is like economics, right? Like, I was looking at it and I was like, whoa, this is this is hard. he's using numbers here, folks. I'm scared. We're going new places. So the numbers of the charts obviously frightened my little brain away. But it's you're using a kind of hybrid approach, obviously.
Exactly. So because I do think that economics, to a large extent, has been designed to confuse other social scientists, I do believe that as an economist, this statement makes me very happy. So to explain a little bit about the origins of the study, so again, there fortunately has been a lot of coverage also within academic circles of conflict studies and political science, people looking at the various actors of this, of the, let's just call it neutrally, conflict. And that is there. However, actually, we've seen that no one has really taken a look at numbers yet. So there are people doing insanely good work online in terms of visualization. So for instance, people recently, two NGOs recently released an online tool where you can actually even track individual airstrikes, which weapons they use, and which obviously European country has actually brought these weapons into the game. But so there has no one really been doing a real numerical study about what actually happens on the ground. And so it's basically absolutely right. It's essentially economic methodology applied to this conflict situation. And so the idea behind a methodology is essentially to say we can observe different things in the war. So again, we have this data set from the Yemen Data Project. And what we can observe is we can observe for every single day, or actually in our case for every week, how many single airstrikes Saudi Arabia has run against Yemen. What we can also see is how much the Houthi movement is advancing within Yemen. And we can observe, so what maybe some of you don't know, the Houthi movement since actually very early place, since more or less the onset from the war, the Houthi movement has also entered Saudi Arabia and has made advances on literally within Saudi Arabia. So we can measure how much happens every week there. And something that we actually found very important, that is actually one of the things that motivated us also to do this story, is to say, okay, well, given how important oil is in Saudi Arabia, so both from an economic perspective, so literally just it's giving the fuel to the economy, and then also from a social perspective, how important oil is just to stabilize this entire weird politics and state system in Saudi Arabia. We're also including oil prices. And so what we're then using is we're using a so-called vector autoregression approach that sounds very fancy. It's actually not that fancy anymore, and it's actually very easy to explain what it's doing. So what it's doing is we're taking these events that we're having for every single week from the onset of the war until 2020. We do know for every single week, again, how many airstrikes are there, how is the Houthi movement progressing in Yemen, how are they advancing within Saudi Arabia, and what's the oil price for that single week. And so we're taking all these weeks, and then we're using this statistical algorithm that can essentially tell us in the end what is going to happen to these variables if something changes. So it allows us to track, okay, if suddenly, let's say, for instance, the oil price increases by a little bit, what's going to happen within the next 10, 20, 30 weeks to the airstrikes, to the performance of the Houthi movement on the ground, and so on. So that's essentially what a method is doing. It's capturing the dynamics of the system, and it's allowing us to tell what's going to happen if any of these variables is changing. How does it reflect on the rest of the conflict?
You're trying to essentially kind of like chart this war's logic.
Yes, exactly.
Like if war can have a logic or reasoning, because you can't, like, is this a kind of general question that's kind of dumb? Like, you know, I'm the humanities, we're in the representation business, which, I mean, I guess everybody is also, but to some degree. But the thing that kind of got me was, forget the fact that obviously it's been sold to us very consciously, very intentionally as a civil war, whereas its complexities are so overwhelming. You have certain parties. I do wonder though why you use Houthi instead of Ansar Allah. They're rebranding. I know you mentioned in the paper, but that's a minor point. But more importantly though, there is a kind of the global logic of this war, situating it in the sort of regional context. And usually that gets subsumed. We just kind of, you know, people kind of throw up their hands, say, oh, the cruelty of this Yemen war, you know, Iran is Yemen's proxy, or, you know, Yemen is Iran's proxy, QED, there you can explain it. You know, and there's like, obviously there's much more to the story. There's like a lot at stake. So maybe the next step we can get into is that maybe you can kind of think about what were the kind of like solid conclusions that you guys made about these links? Like, what did the vector autoregression? Oh boy, that's a scary word to even
awesome,
say.
Awesome, you made
what
it.
Where did it get us? Tell us, teacher, what did you learn?
So before going, I love to discuss more about this. It's actually not just it's so among Western journalists, it's fluently moving between sectarian war, civil war, proxy war, or anything else, and an easy, stupid audience can digest somewhere here. But if we're going to that, let me just briefly respond to the first comment. The entire country is a diplomatic minefield. If I were to write this paper in Arabic, I would probably use Ansar Allah. So just because it has over the recent years emerged, which is, to be honest, you're right, which is a very bad trend actually that should be stopped. But it has unfortunately been established that to use Ansar Allah is already understood as an unobjective statement, so to say. So that's where we're sticking to Houthi in that paper, but obviously, name calling or attaching unobjectivity to certain names is obviously an insanely bad thing for itself. Moving to
can
the
I
conclusion.
Stop you for a second,
yes,
though?
Sure.
Sorry to throw another curveball at you, though. There, you know, you bring up the fact, and I think you sort of explained this earlier in the paper, is that this sort of strategy. The strategy of attacking the movement, when it was, because the name Houthi obviously comes from there's a founder of the movement, right? Like a dude.
Exactly.
It was the name of a guy, right? Like, so
exactly.
There is this name, but the, if you think about it in a kind of broad way, kind of romantic nationalist way, like they martyred this guy and like, you know, as part of their strategy to repress this movement, and therefore they made this guy into like a big deal, in at least in some religious views, unless sort of religious, like there are geopolitical reasons, whatever, like there are real reasons that people support people, not just religion, obviously, but in a if you read in accordance like the religious Shia sense, like this dude like is a real martyr, and
yeah,
this guy has died for something bigger. So it seems ironic that the authorities have insisted on calling it a Houthi movement still, that associating with this hero of it, instead of going along with, you know, what else can be described as kind of like a rebrand, like they have rebranded, I guess we can call it that, Ansar Allah as in, right?
Yeah.
So that was kind of like I wondered about that kind of more generally, of like, don't you want to like move the spotlight away from like the martyred hero?
Absolutely right on that. I don't know to which extent we're going to touch on this, but this whole war and maybe even Saudi foreign policy in a general stance in the past 5 years is filled with giant ironies. And it's mostly that actually you're trying not to do something and you end up achieving exactly that, and even in a very, very expectable or foreseeable way. So if you trace back this movement to somebody, I mean, without going into details, but the whole reason why the Houthis or Ansar Allah actually got that strong is that they were so incredibly and also, just objectively speaking, so badly marginalized over many years. And this entire anti-Saudi resentment that you can find throughout many parts of Yemeni society, and especially in Yemen's north, is just coming from the fact that Saudi Arabia has been meddling with this country for ages, but especially like even including military warfare for the past 20 years. And just like many other things, there is still this, well, if you, I forgot the exact reference, but there was even, there was a Saudi official, I think it was in 2017, concerning the humanitarian issues in Yemen, actually stating pretty forwardly the obvious strategy, if you can call it that, what they're doing in Yemen. So let's first we command them and then we feed them, which is tracing back to this insanely dumb idea of, well, if you just starve Yemen long enough, then they will finally get mad at the Houthis. And that is what's finally going to bring Saudi Arabia the victory, which is an insanely dumb thought, like just like basically all of what's happening there.
Yeah, so I threw us off to another tangent, which was the previous question. So to go back to the question before that, which was, what were the conclusions of the paper?
Yes, absolutely. So again, the conclusions are probably what many observers or analysts of the war would have expected. So what we mainly tested in that paper is we wanted to see, okay, so if Saudi Arabia is behaving according to the official reason of the war. So just remember, the official reason for the war was that Saudi Arabia wanted to basically push back the Houthi movement and to restore what is the internationally recognized government, as by UN definition. And so what you would actually expect is that Saudi Arabia's behavior needs to target the Houthi movement and its expansion. So basically, if the Houthi movement is getting stronger within Yemen, then that would mean that Saudi Arabia needs to do a more intense war. And actually, if it's not doing that, then Saudi Arabia would have no reason to be there. I hope you are getting that. I'm really trying to keep this as well Western neutral as possible. So I'm obviously ignoring the very, very big question if there's any way, any legitimacy in this operation at all. But let's just say for a second that we just go along with this official UN reason stuff for the war. And what we eventually found is that Saudi Arabian airstrikes on Yemen are motivated by a lot of things, but definitely not by what they're supposed to be motivated by. So eventually, they are completely unaffected by advances of Ansar Allah within Yemen, which is again the opposite of what this war was officially about. And then, more ironically, we actually even find that these advances within the country are completely unaffected by Saudi Arabian airstrikes. So not only are Saudi Arabian airstrikes motivated by no one knows what, but definitely not the official reason, we also see that they're doing a lot of stuff. They're targeting many civilians. They're blowing up buses with children every single day, but they're definitely not targeting Ansar Allah, which is, again, given the official reason, what the war was officially about from this international perspective. And
I'm going to quote the paper, because you say, ironically, this is on page 4. Ironically, the government's use of an iron fist against Saada and the Houthis is what elevated their power. The government's rhetoric, which used Houthi as an umbrella term for all tribal Zaydi groups, led to an increasing unification under the Houthi banner in the country's north. Right. So this is exactly what I was saying.
Yeah.
So like, the civilian population in Saada turned loyal to the Houthis in the wake of continued devastation by government offenses against the government, and increasingly pushed the movement into the role of a local government. So like, you naturally turn to the, and this is the lesson we just learned in Gaza, right?
Absolutely.
You naturally turn to the people who defend you from foreign invaders. So like that's just a human, you don't need a PhD to figure that out. You can wrap that up in 10 minutes, go for lunch. Like of course people are going to support Ansar Allah. Of course they're going to support. And so this business of naming them though as the official enemy backfired, because you're the one who behaves like the shithead dirtbag, like pummeling a country that's like militarily weaker than you.
Absolutely. I mean, you can, within Yemen, I mean, everyone can have their personal and political opinion about about Ansar Allah. That's a very, a broad story, but in the end, I'm sorry, but no sane person can be with Saudi Arabia on this thing. Because eventually, no matter how you envision a future Yemen, no matter how negatively you're thinking about the Houthi movement, which is a completely different story. It is Saudi Arabia that is currently bombing their way through the country. And the irony is just, as you said, so the quote, thank you, that you just gave is eventually mainly referring to what happened in the early 2000s. So there's not even a learning process, essentially. So this is essentially what happened, especially from around 2008. So this is not obviously not the first time. It's actually, I don't know, how many 10th, 20th time that Saudi Arabia is invading Yemen. And even just very recently, in 2008, exactly that happened. So they attacked the most northern governorates of Yemen. And obviously what happened is people turned against Saudi Arabia increasingly, and people started to side with the guys that are defending them on the ground. And apparently, again, there's not a single bit of learning in there, because 2015 and past, we're still seeing the same idiot strategy of just thinking that, well, if you just picture them bad enough in media, then whatever, the local population is going to forgive you if you just bomb them, which is, again, insanely stupid.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing is that, like, the problem, one of the sort of problems with your, not problems with your study, but, like, you're doing a thought experiment, right, in this research paper, and you're kind of testing things, which, yeah, that's, yeah, that's what academia is for. But then, like, there is the obvious, like, well, they could be lying. Like, they could be lying about what they're saying. And obviously, as you guys show, they're not doing that. They're not, this is not the sort of goal of this project, right? Like, we can't think of it in terms of, like, rational actors pursuing sort of some geopolitical goal, because maybe the war itself is the goal. And, you know, like the famous statement, like, war is a racket. Like, war is a racket. And there is, there is a kind of logic to the escalation of this, which you guys point out, is that it begins with this iron fist, and then using your, I mean, classic story of, like, political unraveling, right? Like,
absolutely.
A resistance movement pops up to the government that is allied with you, that's, like, basically not your proxy, but essentially your, I mean, how would you describe Saudi, Yemen in the 90s? It's basically like it's not a Quisling state, but it's definitely the junior partner in the region, right?
Essentially,
the
major
power. Let's put it gracefully. But then a movement pops up that resists that status quo, that challenges that status quo, and you try to stamp it out. The movement turns into a national movement. The movement turns into a national armed resistance movement. And then, like, the movement then makes connections with outside actors, the same way that you yourself are a result of outside actors, and also are, like, the fact that, yeah, like, the Saudi military is a hodgepodge of, like, various Western military corporations, like, whatever they
Absolutely.
Can buy. Like, so, like, this is, like, you guys are sort of, like, deconstructing the logic of the war. Now, like, can we do, like, the obvious kind of, like, back of the napkin at a bar kind of calculation of, like, okay, what's their fucking game here? Like, what is this just, this can't just be idiocy. Like, you can't, I feel like it's not good enough.
And no, absolutely, absolutely not. So what I would, I would say, there is irrational. Rational doesn't necessarily mean connected to mainstream politics, but definitely is. Saudi Arabia does have a rational, internally speaking, rational reason to do this war. But maybe before going into that, I would like to highlight, I do firmly believe that this war has an inherently emotional component. So I feel that generally the relation and the entire view that Saudi Arabia, and unfortunately also many people within Saudi Arabia, do have on Yemen and Yemenis, it's maybe closely described or can be compared to, for instance, the thing that Germans have with Turks, or maybe to some degree how US Americans approach Mexicans. So this whole idea of, well, they are more or less neighboring country and they're supposed to clean our toilets. Exactly, they're the neighboring underclass, and it goes completely, like, until as long as they clean your toilets, you're happy about that. But as soon as there is any kind of resistance against that status quo in the broadest sense, you just can't tolerate that. So I generally believe that in a completely emotional way, that Saudi Arabia doesn't really want to see a successful or stable or flourishing Yemen.
Right. Exactly. And so, like, that's part of it's the lessons of this war, right? Like, are multiform in the sense that, like, you have, on the one hand, you have, this is like the future of war, or at least a kind of war, which is, of course, like, everything kind of, like, subcontracted to private actors. You have, like, a private air force. You have, like, a conventional air force, which, you know, we were talking a little bit before, has dominated the nature of the airstrikes, but also during the time of this fighting, like from 2015 to now, drone warfare has changed the calculus of the whole region, and not just for the good for the Saudis, right? Like they keep getting hit harder and harder, which we should talk about actually, the results of those attacks. There is a kind of like, no, I don't want to say divine justice, but a kind of historically, like what goes up must come down. And so the strategy of sort of using air power, eventually that has caught up with them, and in that the Yemenis can now hit them and has hit them really hard now. But maybe we can you like, maybe the people who have missed this, who are sort of new to the podcast, can you give us like a Cole's Notes version of the timeline of this war, of what happens? Because the early history, I mean, and there's a lot of that in the paper. You kind of explain the sort of lead up to it very clearly and very straightforwardly. So maybe kind of tell us a little bit about the devolution in the second half of the 2000s or whatever, and then leading up to 2011, and then 2015 shifts into this new phase.
Absolutely. What happened? So I think it's very important again just to understand how this war is actually born in a weird imbroglio of different perspectives. It's really important to look both at what happened in Saudi Arabia and what happened in Yemen to see how this came into being. So what happened in Yemen essentially is that prior to 2011, so Yemen was governed by elected, but mostly autocratic government under Ali Abdullah Saleh. This government eventually disintegrated increasingly from 2005 and till 2011. It is, by the way, worth stating. During that time, actually, Saudi Arabia and the Yemeni government used to be, I wouldn't necessarily call them too close allies, but their kind of general thinking was more or less in line. And what happened then is that in 2011, the entire state body in Yemen finally collapsed. And what happened within this collapse is that actually a lot of forces from the old government, many of them also loyal to Saudi Arabia, part of that is also due to meddling from the northern side, actually regained power. And then when there was this whole chaos about getting a transitional government, getting a new government, Ansarullah, again, a movement initially mainly consisting out of people from North Yemen, increasingly also armed, at some point said, okay, to break this really down as easy as possible, they said one day, okay, whatever is happening here, it is not reflecting how a transitional government should look like. It is not reflecting how a unified and inclusive approach towards a new Yemeni state should look like. And so what happened is they stormed the capital. They took over the government, and the former transitional government under President Hadi was forced out of the capital, and eventually he fled to Saudi Arabia. And in Saudi Arabia, what he would eventually do is he would ask the UN Security Council and also the Gulf Cooperation Council for a military intervention to restore his government. What's happening at the same time in Saudi Arabia, what is again important, very crucial to understand the sort of background of why Saudi Arabia is reacting the way it does. So after King Abdullah finally died, what happened is King Salman took the throne. And most notably, he appointed his, for Arabian standards, pretty young son, Mohammed bin Salman, as initially Minister of Defense. So he's actually the guy that started the war. And then later, using a lot of internal Game of Thrones and House of Cards structures, he eventually pushed himself to the to be the crown prince. And the one that we basically all know.
MBS is a real dark horse candidate for
absolutely.
All of this, right? He came out of nowhere.
This was a prison. Not a regular prison with cells and bars, but a luxury hotel used to detain from November 2017 some of Saudi Arabia's most powerful men, ministers, princes, and this man, Saudi Arabia's richest businessman, Prince Al-Waleed bin Talal, who owns shares of Citigroup, the Four Seasons, Twitter, and Euro Disney. Like the other detainees, he's accused of corruption.
There are no charges.
Okay.
There's just some discussions between the government, you know. I mean, but rest assured that this is a clean operation that we have. And we're just in discussion with the government on various matters.
Days later, the prince settled with authorities. The royal court says 87 people settled like him, and all of them confessed. Figures released as Saudi Arabia ends its so-called Clean Hands campaign. 64 people will be prosecuted. And the figure that Saudi Arabia pushes forward in its graphics, the amount collected through settlements, $106 billion.
Absolutely, and I really think that, in a sense, MBS is really incorporating the spirit of a time where just so much inconsistent stuff can happen so suddenly. So if you asked someone, I don't know, 15, 20 years back, can you imagine that some guy who's not even in the line to get a throw is just suddenly pushing himself to the throne? People have said, no, that's completely impossible. Because what I think that is very important to understand about Saudi Arabia is that, classically speaking, so what basically everyone is probably getting, one of the things holding together society is definitely redistributing oil wealth. But the other thing holding Saudi society together is just this actually very concrete idea of stability, of the idea of, okay, well, even if there's a king and even if he actually might steal all of the money that doesn't belong to him, but, well, still, at the very least, we do not have any kind of succession wars. So this question of who's a ruler is finally answered and we can live in peace. Kind of this sense of stability, of succession is really one of the essential things holding together Saudi society. And so someone from the outside just bluntly coming and completely walking over these traditions, it is a very bold move in a sense. It's a move that people wouldn't really have thought with. And that is essentially what's also this, what we refer to as maybe the rational side of the war. So a lot about the Yemen war is actually about this young ruler proving himself, about regaining the legitimacy that he might have lost on his bumpy way to the throne. And so we also see that very much if we look at how the Yemen war is pictured in Saudi media and across the region. So the Ansarullah is not even directly depicted as something that happens in a foreign country, as a foreign force. They're literally depicted as terrorists. So basically Saudi Arabia is, in a sense, reacting. Its military is reacting a situation in where, oh, we're just taking care of the mean terrorists that will finally catch you. It's not a foreign thing. We're actually not even going to another country. We're just providing you security.
Yeah, and then they have the audacity there, or at least their fucking Saudi fund, the agents of their press, have the audacity to call fucking Ansarullah Iran proxies. It's like, excuse me. Excuse me. you want to talk about proxies?
We were talking about irony. So the giant irony is actually that if you really look at the hard evidence, now this time it's really well known there is at least some communication in the broader sense between Ansarullah and Iran, but this hasn't started until Saudi Arabia, and that time also especially the Trump administration in the US, started designing this insanely dumb idea of picturing the whole thing as a proxy war. And if I may, I know that this notion of a proxy war is even somewhat popular within Yemen. And what I find so grotesque and so horrific about it is, especially if it's coming from Yemenis, that this is not about if you personally have a positive or negative attitude towards Ansarullah, that's a different story. But at the very least, it is a movement that is coming from within Yemen. It's a genuine movement that's coming from within Yemen. And by saying, especially as a Yemeni, by saying this is a proxy war, you are stealing the last little bit of agency that Yemen still has in the story. By eventually saying to yourself, yeah, but we're absolutely not part of it. This is just a weird war between Saudi Arabia and Iran. It's factually
untrue.
Yeah,
that's what the same thing with Hezbollah and Israel and Iran, right? Like, oh, it's just a proxy. Like, it's just something that they say, but it's like but there is a kind of truth in the sense that, like, this is part of regional war, and it's not a proxy, but it is a theater of a larger regional war. And there is a truth of that, in that sense that, like, Saudi Arabia does represent one of the regional actors. It likes to think of itself as like the regional powerhouse, but it's really not. It's just like, it has a lot of military, but it's not a powerhouse.
Yeah.
Like, those are two separate things. Like, but like, it likes to sort of think of itself as the big heavyweight, but in reality, its military sort of strength has never really been tested against an enemy that could really do some damage to it. It's
true.
Basically, it is a kind of like, you know, with the, at what point do you confuse the Saudi military power with American military power? At what point does American military power end and Saudi military power begin, right? Because these are allies in a historic alliance, right? Like, that's been going on for over a century now. Like, when did they, no, not a century, it was FDR.
Conclusion to the historic Yalta Conference as a plane carries President Roosevelt to Egypt to solidify ties in the Middle East. Then representing Saudi Arabia comes King Ibn Saud, and a destroyer put at his disposal, the first U.S. vessel of its kind to pass through the Suez Canal during this war. The ship's vast decks are covered with rich oriental rugs. It's the first time in the life of King Ibn Saud that he has left his country's own soil. On his 800-mile trip from the Red Sea port of Jeddah, he is accompanied by 48 men, among them his sons and many famous sheikhs. The Arabian monarch goes aboard the president's cruiser to be received amid impressive and colorful ceremonies. This conference was no doubt among the most important of these meetings, and presumably centered on the vastly important question of oil, the potential American development of the oil concession granted by the king. Meanwhile, as the two leaders talk, the king's party have a look at the cruiser. Their flowing garments and turbans add a picturesque note to the conference. But Navy preparations for dinner are as humdrum as ever. Final phase of new meetings in the Middle East. One more allied step toward total victory and a lasting peace.
70 yeah, years, 80 years. Yeah. So like, this is an important historic regional force country, which a part of another one too, like the different ones that they've collected. So like, it's just like to dismiss this all as just kind of proxy and all that stuff is just like intellectually lazy. Like, you know, it's obviously orientalist because, oh, didn't you know?
Did you know
there's only one war. That's all you have to talk about. It's all about Iran. And it's just like, and this is always like the Zionist thing too, of like, make it always about Iran. It's always about Iran, 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 Iran. And then you can do whatever you want in the meantime, right? You can run your insanely expensive, destructive war. And then, I mean, we should get into, like, you know, the costs of this war. Of course, the human costs in Yemen are astronomical, and I've done a few episodes about it. But, like, over time, though, the infrastructure, the force of Yemeni firepower has increased considerably in a short amount of time, too. So what did you notice any differences?
Absolutely.
In your paper?
If you just allow me, before coming to the cost of war, I just again want to get into this intellectually poor description of the war itself. So with proxy war, it's anyway obvious, but another, I haven't decided yet if I find the proxy war story more stupid or the sectarian war story. So the sectarian war narrative has been especially popular in Europe, so especially when it began, which is, again, as you had said, which is just this insanely orientalist approach of, well, so in Europe, we actually don't know a lot more than, well, there's Shia, there's Sunni, and so, oh yeah, that's a perfect pattern to put on that war, which again, couldn't be further from the truth. So it's not only a misrepresentation of this very war, but again, it's taking away the agency from the point that there could be real political struggles on the ground, and just breaking it down to, oh well, there are two dumb different religious groups that I anyway can't pronounce, and so yeah, probably it's just that, which is so incredibly lazy, and I'm continuously shocked by how often these two perspectives, so either just picturing it as a proxy war, so anyway there are no Yemenis involved, or just proxying it, or just depicting it as a as a sectarian war, which again is it couldn't be further from
like
the truth.
If Iran was as implicated in the war as like our the sort of media flunkies suggest online, this war would have ended a long time ago.
Absolutely, like, absolutely.
Like a tiny fraction of Iran's military power would
absolutely.
Really change. And like supposedly the attacks, what was it? Not Abha, the other one in 2019.
Abqaiq.
Yeah, exactly. That one was a game changer, right? In terms of the calculus?
Essentially. So, coming back to the Iran story, so it is very likely and also semi-evident that again there is some communication between the two countries, maybe even some technology transfer. But this weird belief of Iran sending in military or even sending in grave weaponage is just, I mean, again, I'm running an NGO. You can't imagine how insanely complicated it has become to get damn humanitarian aid, to get a solar panel into Yemen. And there are still these media-provoked images of basically, yeah, there are, I don't know, maybe we reach at the imaginary of a giant tunnel between Iran and Yemen. It doesn't make any sense. You think coming to the oil attack? Absolutely. I mean, part of this... of this Saudi narrative of Yemen just being the underdeveloped, retarded neighbor is also not believing that Yemen could actually do anything. So if you look back into policy circles when the war actually began, the signals you got from Saudi Arabia were very literally, we're going to take care of Yemen within 7 days.
Yes, and they called it 7 years ago. They called it Saudi-led coalition. They did that thing. They did the American thing. They called it a coalition. Like, they can't even come up with their own media framing. Okay? An idiot can do that.
College
students can get that. How come there isn't a dude with a BA somewhere in Riyadh who's like, fellas, let's not copy the American template, okay? Let's come up with our own. We'll call it something else. Let's maybe use an Arabic word. No, they called it coalition.
Saudi-led military forces in Yemen have defeated the country's rebels at a strategic southern airbase, the Yemeni Defense Ministry said on Tuesday. Coalition forces advanced on the Al Anad base near the port city of Aden on Monday afternoon and subsequently took control of the facility. The victory built upon a string of recent gains in the south by the coalition, which includes Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Qatar, Bahrain, Egypt, and a number of other Arab states. The rebels, a Shiite-linked militant group known as the Houthis, have been driven from Aden in recent weeks, setting the stage for coalition forces to make a further push northward into other Houthi-controlled areas. Yemen's instability began last year when the Houthis extended their territorial control to the south and took control of the capital, Sana'a. The Houthis took control of the government in February and sent Saudi-backed President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi into exile the following month. The Houthis took the Al Anad base in March as they consolidated control over southern Yemen. Saudi Arabia assembled the coalition and launched a campaign of airstrikes to oust the Houthis and restore Hadi to power. The air campaign didn't produce a reversal on the battlefield until last month, when coalition forces pushed the Houthis out of Aden. On Saturday, Yemen's exiled Prime Minister Khaled Baha returned to Aden. However, Mr. Hadi still remains in Saudi Arabia.
You're talking again, please. You're referring to the country that tried to starve the richest country on earth, and that basically started a diplomatic war about a tweet. So
yeah, that's true.
I would lower the bar.
Yeah, they threatened Canada with 9/11 on Twitter. I gotta admit, of all the things Saudi Arabia has done in this world, that's probably one of the cooler things.
Definitely. I mean, it was a cool move, but then I usually do polls, kind of if you just summarize what happened over the past 5 years. So ranging from again. Starving Qatar, an insanely great idea, because I mean this hasn't worked in Yemen, so Well, it's definitely going to work in Qatar. Awesome. This weird picture of planes driving into flying into Canada, kidnapping the Lebanese prime minister.
Oh yeah, killing
a guy in your consulate and thinking the rest of the world would be completely okay with it.
And flushing his body parts down the toilet or something. Found the body parts. The Turkish guys found it. Oh god.
So by the way, if you ask me on that one, I genuinely believe, and that's actually what makes it even more ridiculous, that they did intend, so their intention was for this whole thing to be uncovered, but they, which is actually even dumber, they didn't think which backlash there would be. So they really didn't think, oh my god, like even for, at least media-wise, at least diplomacy-wise, Europe and the US would be completely okay with that, kind of this degree of completely not understanding how the world works. So in between these lines, I'm really unsure which was the dumbest move. I am not sure, because all of them are in an insane own category.
If this story wasn't so incredibly evil, like, you could just laugh and like, oh my god,
yeah,
put the Benny Hill soundtrack under the entire foreign policy of Saudi Arabia. But like, ultimately, like, you know, these actors and these nefarious actors in this region are part of this like sick, depraved game, like murder game that the imperials like to play, that funds
absolutely
a huge chunk of Western capitalism of like it's not just like the Humvees and the fucking planes and the fucking like whatever fucking submarines. It's the banking, it's the dollars, it's the subservience of so much Gulf money, supposedly in the hand of these monarchs that are less than 100 years old, most of these supposed monarchies,
yeah,
that were invented out of whole cloth from Yemen, not Yemen, from the Gulf, you know, to Jordan, whatever, Iraq. They just invented
absolutely
these monarchs. And like, and now like the tiny country of Yemen, right, scratches and claws its way to like a tiny degree of sovereignty that they don't like. And these Western powers send its, I mean, this is my personal reading, they send their, you know, imperial pit bull, colonial subjugated pit bull, Saudi Arabia, to go and attack this country to teach it a lesson, because you can't get away with cutting yourself off from that system. And Saleh, I mean, Saleh is another story. I mean, I didn't
know this
code. Saleh is another story because, you know, his own ending was authored by himself in a sense, because
absolutely
he almost made the smart move at the right time, and then he did make the smart move, and then he immediately undid that move and then got himself killed. So like, there's that element to it of like, but anyways, maybe
let me just briefly get to these international implications, because I really think they're completely, it's so whenever we talk about Yemen, I really think it's important not only to stress the obvious, again, both culpability and idiocy that's coming from Saudi Arabia, but also stressing just how far reaching this is. And if you look at I would frame the terms a little bit different, but essentially I do share your point. So I do think that this obviously there's the first thing of just, well, they're making hell of a money by saying by selling arms to Saudi Arabia. So it was, I think it was in 2017, where there was this almost comical element of Mohammed bin Salman going to DC and giving a giant check, and Donald Trump giving this giant check.
They had to rent floors from Trump and his hotel. He was the cheapest buy of the
it's
U.S.
So cheap.
Like, empire.
It's so
he
cheap.
Was just like, oh my god, billing.
And I mean, that's the, you're putting yourself there just as a giant cash cow. I mean, even as the ruler of Saudi Arabia, I find this is a move that, well, isn't there a tiny degree of, well, I don't know, dignity, or, well, apparently not. But besides that, I mean, besides this obvious thing of making money, I do completely believe that this is still somewhat falling back to this inherently evil and inhumane and orientalist CIA doctrine and perspective on the whole region of basically defining stability essentially means that war is regionally confined. So as long as only brown people kill each other, for us Americans, for us as CAA, this is basically meaning stability. So we, in terms of international policy, prefer basically Saudi Arabia bombing the shit out of Yemen to whatever else there could be.
Yeah, and that's the stage of things. I mean, that's also like, I don't know if the analogy really works, but I find that the problem that, like, Gazans now have Yemeni people problems in this, or at least maybe the other way around. Like, they have quarantined Gaza away from the rest of Palestine, or tried to at least. And also they have quarantined the sea, right? The same thing they did to Yemen, right? They cut off the country in the hopes of isolating it. So first you resist them, they try to kill you, you come back, you assert some kind of, let's say, national sovereignty. I know that's complicated in the Palestinian case. I guess it's also complicated in the Yemeni case too, because
apparently
there are parts of the country that don't recognize Ansar Allah's authority.
Exactly.
Or like, so it's not as easy to sort of just say like national authority, but something as resembling national authority as you can has been achieved by Ansar Allah, and they are, you know, even if they're not elected, they are a part of the Yemeni state now. And they're deeper, the longer that this goes on, the deeper entrenched they become. You have to assume that it's going to attract more Yemeni youth who are like, oh, who are the dudes who have fought
Absolutely.
Off these dudes? Oh, I'm going to go with them. It looks like they have something going on that I want to support because I'm just a fucking regular Yemeni dude and I want to like defend my country. So like, it's not, I don't know, the sectarian thing, the thing that we always do, not we, but like we always have to hear people do on this part of the world is like always find a nice, convenient framework, a nice keyword that can sum it all up. And it's like, no, man, it's like this fucking geopolitical game that we're in, especially in our region, is dirty business. And there are wars, dirty wars. They're sold as sort of media objects at a certain degree, depends on the context. Sometimes they're sort of kept from the light. And that's also been the story of Yemen too. And it's part of a larger, like very gross imperial game that the Yemenis have proven themselves like able players in the sense that they're fighting back and asserting a very real sovereignty that terrifies imperialists and Saudis too, right? Like, oh shit, like we can't just beat up on our southern neighbors anymore.
There is something to be honest, I myself, I do have obviously a couple of issues with Ansar Allah, with the way they're handling many things, but something I always deeply respected about the movement is that from the very start, from the very start onwards, that they actually said that, well, our main target is actually getting rid of these overly Western, so especially of American influence in our country. We want to claim back our country that just for too long time has been part of a game that it actually has no place in. And so this sense of looking behind the curtain and understanding the insane role that US imperialism and colonialism still have in the region and in the country, that is something I deeply respect about the movement.
Yeah, ain't that the way it goes? Daoud, this was a very enlightening conversation. Thank you. Thank you for this work. I'm going to link to it.
Thank you.
Do you want to tell us more, a little bit, anything else? What have you been working on? What should we look out for?
I wasn't prepared for this one. So what we're going to do is definitely, so we're going to continue both our data-driven work and just spreading academic work on Yemen. And I can maybe call on other people to so if you're working in research, use the privilege that you have in order to work towards something that that is beneficial to the world and to people who are oppressed. I was shocked both during the Gaza war and throughout 7 years of the Yemen war, how many academic voices stayed silent in the wake of this crisis, and B, continuing to support small grassroots organizations that do work on the ground and help people.